This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 11th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, raising the minimum wage in Arkansas. One group thinks it has enough signatures to get this issue on the ballot this fall. Plus, we have a report on regional accents.
And we learned three things you should know about CPR. Monster trucks prepare to roll into Fort Smith and more.
But first, yesterday's runoff election resulted in a big win for Leslie Rutledge, the Little Rock attorney who secured the GOP nomination for Arkansas Attorney General. Roby Brock of Talk Business and Politics says there are two big takeaways from yesterday's election.
Leslie Rutledge defeated David Sterling by an overwhelming margin, about 59% to 41%. I think two things were really at play. Number one, there was a lot of outside money spent in this campaign that was attacking Leslie Rutledge, and that seemed to backfire. I heard a lot of that anecdotally. I think that the numbers kind of support that there was definitely a backlash from some of that anti-Rutledge advertising. The other thing is that ground games typically win runoff elections, and that is, how well do you know who your supporters are, and can you get them to come back out to the polls for you in a runoff election? Leslie Rutledge clearly did that. In the 15 most populous counties in terms of voter turnout in this runoff election, she won 13 of those 15 counties. That's a sign of an excellent ground game.
Rutledge will face Democrat Nate Steele and Libertarian Aaron Cash in November's general election. But aside from the candidates being set in this year's attorney general race, Roby says another takeaway from yesterday's election is centered around the Arkansas private option.
Representative John Burris was running for an open state Senate seat up in north central Arkansas. He's one of the chief architects of the private option. He was defeated by Scott Flippo, who opposes the private option. So now you have another vote in the Arkansas State Senate that is opposing private option funding that is going to raise the threshold of difficulty for supporters of the private option to be able to renew that funding come next January.
Earlier this year, funding for the private option passed the Arkansas House by a 76-24 margin, and the Senate passed funding for the program at 27-8 with not a single vote to spare.
State lawmakers are mulling over whether to allow K-12 public schools access to the state-owned internet infrastructure. The Arkansas Research Education Optical Network, or ARON, delivers high-speed internet to most state colleges as well as several hospitals. But extending service to public schools is not allowed under the law authorizing the network. After a legislative hearing earlier this week, Committee Chair Senator Johnny Key said the decision isn't about providing free internet. It's about providing an alternative to private internet providers.
If you're happy with the service that you're getting and you have a provider that's giving it to you at a quality and cost, no one is ever saying they'd take that away. I understand the providers are concerned with a notion of getting into the private business, but we're talking about a public school. Okay, so the other side says, well, public school, we use public tax dollars for that. You're trying to hook up a public entity, a public-owned network.
A committee formed by the Arkansas Department of Education and chaired by Axiom Vice President Jerry Jones says ARON has a vastly superior bandwidth capacity through a research-only network called Internet 2. Jones says by leasing privately owned connection links to link to ARON, costs would be driven down, especially in underserved rural areas.
The fiber is there. The cost that is being charged to some of the school districts is higher than what we think could be paid otherwise.
Several legislators and an industry association for rural telecom companies argued allowing public schools to use ARON would be unfair competition for private companies. If the option to use ARON does become available through a change in the law, it would be up to school districts to allocate funds for access.
The summer meals program at Fort Smith Public Schools started this week. Lunch is being served at Ballman, Barling, Carnell, Howard, and Trustee Elementary Schools. And lunch and breakfast are being served at Morrison, Pike, Spradling, Sunnymead, and Tills Elementary Schools. Tim Regan, the school district's nutrition education coordinator, says the district serves free breakfast during the summer because it serves breakfast during the school year.
So if there's a demand for breakfast in the community, we try to fulfill that demand. But, you know, breakfast continues to be one of the most important meals of the day, even in the summertime. So at some of our higher volume schools, we put a staff in place to offer breakfast to the community.
Regan says the nutritional content of the summer meals is the same as meals served during the school year.
Fruits and vegetables will be served at each lunch. Meals will be rich in whole grains. Total calories will be limited to the USDA maximums. So there'll be no compromise between what we serve to our students during the regular school year and what we're serving to all children during the summer.
Like summer meals programs at other area school districts, children 18 years old and younger can eat for free, and funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture supports the program.
The Southern Baptist Convention of Churches has a new president today, and he's from the area. Ronnie Floyd, who has been pastor of Cross Church for 27 years, was elected to the top post of the Southern Baptist Convention in a vote held yesterday in Baltimore. Floyd received nearly 52% of the 3,553 votes cast, topping fellow nominees Dennis Kim, a pastor from Maryland, and Jared Moore, a pastor from Kentucky. Floyd succeeds New Orleans pastor Fred Luter in leading the Southern Baptist Convention.
As the filing period nears for this year's municipal races in the area, one more has announced intentions to run for Fayetteville City Council. Ward 2 Position 1 Alderman Mark Kenyon announced yesterday that he intends to run for re-election for his seat on the council.
The University of Arkansas men's and women's track teams are in Eugene, Oregon today to open the NCAA championship meet at Hayward Field. The men enter as the fourth-ranked team in the country, and the women begin the meet ranked seventh in the nation. The meet continues through Saturday.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals winning streak is over at 3. Last night, the Travelers beat the Nats 3-2 in North Little Rock. The Naturals play tonight in Springfield.
Tonight, expect mostly clear skies with overnight lows from 58 in Northwest Arkansas to 64 in the Arkansas River Valley. There's an 80% chance for showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, highs from 75 to 80. Showers and thunderstorms likely tomorrow evening, lows from 59 to 63.
This is Ozarks at Large. Supporters of a law to raise the state minimum wage from $6.25 an hour to $8.50 an hour over the next 3 years have gathered what they think are enough signatures to qualify for the November general election ballot. The signatures will have to be reviewed and approved by the Secretary of State's office first. Who does raising the state's minimum wage really help? Where will the money come from to support this endeavor? To find out more, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics recently sat down with the Reverend Stephen Copley, who leads Give Arkansas a Raise Now, the group pushing this ballot initiative.
So you think you got your numbers? You think you got your signatures? You're at least over the threshold.
We're still collecting signatures, just because, as you said in the intro, we want to make sure that there'll be, you know, issues about validation and those kind of things. So we're going to continue to collect till we're ready to turn them in, just to make sure.
And the cutoff date for turn them in July 7th.
That's correct.
All right, so we'll know more a little after the July 4th holiday here. I want to pull up a poll that we did recently back in April to gauge support for the minimum wage. We found, when we asked people this in our Arkansas Hendricks College poll, 79% support raising the minimum wage, the state minimum wage, 17% opposed. Do those numbers really surprise you?
No, they don't. I think folks know that instinctively. They know they have a family member, a friend, a colleague that are, they're working hard, they're playing by the rules, and they can't make ends meet. So no, it doesn't surprise me at all.
All right. There's some things that people need to know about raising the minimum wage. I think we have another graph here that talks about just some of the elements of it here. This proposal that you guys have proposes raising it to $8.50 from $6.25 an hour over the next 3 years. Businesses have to have more than 4 employees, less than $500,000 in sales, although I think the higher wage prevails, so this will apply to many more businesses if it should pass.
That's correct.
So are you worried about the impact on business on this? This will have a cost for some folks, particularly the hospitality industry, which has expressed some concerns. There's other businesses as well.
Well, and certainly we would have some concern. You don't want to see business harm, but we think that with the tiering in, that gives time for folks to budget in that increase into their plans. And studies usually have shown that when there is an increase, in many ways productivity increases. Workers are happier. Job sickness, illness, job loss decreases. So we think that it levels out in the long run.
You've run through some numbers with me before about how much the minimum wage calculates on an annual basis for someone. What's the dollar amount for someone make a minimum wage in Arkansas?
Well, if they're, you know, right now the state minimum wage is 6.25, and that's about $13,500 a year. And what's interesting is if you say somebody spends $100 a week on groceries, there's $5,200. If they spend $300 for their housing a month, they've spent $9,000, and they've just bought their groceries and their housing, and those are probably low figures. So you have automobile, gasoline, insurance, clothes, and it, folks just can't make those ends meet.
We've seen some Democratic candidates, Senator Mark Pryor, Democratic nominee for Governor Mike Ross, have come out in support of this measure. I want to kind of pull up a third graphic that we have here about where some contributions from the Arkansas Interfaith Alliance, which is you're part of and is working with on this issue too. Big dollars coming from this group to help underwrite this cause. You've got Pinnacle Structures, which is a business in Cabot. You've got a couple of different unions here with some big dollar contributions, the Democratic Party of Arkansas. I guess I have not seen any Republicans come out in support of raising the state minimum wage. I've asked a few and they've been undecided at this point in time. Are we going to see some bipartisan support for this issue eventually?
Well, that would be our plan. We're concerned about the issue because it's the right thing to do. People need more money in their pockets, and we've said from the very beginning, anybody who would like from any party to endorse this, we would be very welcome, very entertaining of that.
Are you working on some potential Republicans right now?
We are going to begin to do that, yes, to reach out to them and encourage them and see if they would endorse this. So it really is, from our perspective, a bipartisan effort, and we'd welcome anybody to be part of it.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business and Politics, speaking with Reverend Stephen Copley from the group Give Arkansas a Raise Now. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Next time on Philosophy Talk, a philosophical summer reading list.
What better way to spend a lazy summer evening than with a good book, especially a good philosophy book?
Whether it's fiction, fact, or pure philosophy that strikes your fancy, you'll want to join in the fun.
You'll hear suggestions not just from Ken and me, but from callers and past guests, too.
It's our philosophical summer reading list, next time on Philosophy Talk.
Listen Friday at 6 p.m. to KUAF3.
Knowing how to perform CPR can help save lives. Anyone can learn by signing up for a course. And over the years, the curriculum has changed.
I don't know when the next update is. The last update was done in 2012, and it has become more and more cardiac-based and cardiac-focused. And so if we can narrow it down to that specific basis, that the basis of most adult emergencies is cardiac related, then we can simplify the curriculum to kind of affect the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's kind of, you know, where the updates have gone in the last few years.
In about 12 minutes, we learn three things you should know about CPR. That story's just ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Regional accents, scholars say, change over time as cultures drift and migrate around the globe. But some worry, into the 21st century and beyond, American regional accents may disappear altogether. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently spoke with a University of Arkansas psycholinguist about accents and has this report.
I'm Peggy Stratton, and I'm from Russellville, Arkansas. I'm Grandma visiting.
As you can hear, Peggy Stratton is a native Arkansan. She's in Fayetteville visiting her son, who she says shares her southern drawl. He's at work today, but Peggy's having a picnic this morning at Wilson Park with her grandsons, Beau, who's 5, and Jet, who's 7. And Jet says, yeah, they have a family pet, an elderly Weimaraner.
She's deaf. She can't hear anything. She doesn't obey anything you do.
What?
She doesn't even listen to you.
Despite his Arkansas roots, Jet speaks with a neutral accent. Again, this is his grandmother, Peggy Stratton.
It may be from living up here and the different groups that live here and people from so many different areas.
Doug Barrand studies American accents. He's a professor in the Department of Psychological Science at the University of Arkansas.
I study language and cognitive development in young children.
Professor Barrand, as you can hear, is from the North.
I was born in a city called East Orange, New Jersey, and this is how they spoke in northern New Jersey. And so if I go back there, I'll go to my nephew's wedding in Scranton, Pennsylvania next fall, and there'll be a lot of people who will sound like this.
Even Professor Barrand has lost much of his urban northeastern accent, he says, having moved away. America, Professor Barrand says, has a wealth of accents.
Well, American accents are quite diverse. They are mutually intelligible. That means almost everybody in the country who speaks American English will be able to understand almost everybody who speaks American English from another part of the country. But they are very diverse. So between the Northeast and the Deep South and the Upper Midwest in particular, those I think are where the most distinct accents are.
When he first moved to the Ozarks more than 20 years ago, Doug Barrand said he was a bit confounded by what he heard.
I moved into my house, needed some cleaning supplies, went to the old Walmart in Fiesta Square. The cashier greeted me with a, "You doing all right?" And like the psycholinguist I am, I said, "What?" I could not understand what she was saying. So she said, "You doing all right?" And she said that again. And I didn't understand her 2 or 3 times. And finally, she looked at me and sort of scrunched her nose up and said, "How are you today, sir?"
Barrand says some of us have an ear for accents. Back at Wilson Park, 2-year-old Rayland Frazier picks up tiny stones and carries them to a walking bridge to toss into the creek while her mom, Jenny, watches.
What do you do?
I'm moving.
You're going to do a more big splash?
Small verbal interactions like this are language teaching moments in a toddler's life, says Doug Barrand. But accents are a different thing.
It's not the case that everybody will pick up equally strongly on the accents of the speech that they hear around them. So again, I was born and raised in New Jersey. My parents didn't have a particularly strong northeastern accent, but mine was considerably, and I think those of my siblings were considerably weaker than those of my parents. One of the things that we do know is that children, especially as they get older, begin to adopt the accents, are more likely to adopt the accents of their peers.
American teenage girls in particular are masters at inventing vocal trends, linguists say. The 1980s California Valley Girl was the first contemporary affect to emerge using uptalk or high-rising intonation. But 2 years ago, the Journal of Voice published a paper on a new and opposite phenomenon classified as vocal fry, when a speaker drops their voice into a low, creaky register. A great example are their Kardashian sisters. Here's Kim giving a morning TV show interview.
It just seems like everything's completely intensified, and it's a lot greater than I ever would have expected.
And singer Katy Perry joking with a girlfriend, mocking the affect.
Super popular.
I'm so excited. Are you excited?
So excited.
All right, let's get started.
Now, the female cast of Saturday Night Live love to mock affected female accents, including Kristen Wiig, here impersonating a Barbie doll with a lisp, also a new trend. Scholars say the frontal sibilant lisp among young women and celebrities, note Mad Men, is very much in vogue.
I've been a nurse, a stewardess, an astronaut. I got fired from all of them.
Why do you think that is?
Almost, if not every job requires elbows.
Those are all parodies of current female affects, but Professor Doug Barron says such language devices help young women to bond.
What we know from research, especially research by my colleague Catherine Kinsler at the University of Chicago, is that accent and children adopt the accent and language of the peer, their peers around them in order to feel like they belong to the group. Adopting a language is not very different, or an accent is not very different from adopting a particular type of shoe style or hairstyle in order to fit in. So children, when a type of speech becomes popular within their group, if they want to feel like they are members of the group or to be accepted by the group, they are going to be likely to accept that, to adopt those speech patterns as well.
And certain young people purposely lose their regional accent in order to conform.
To the degree that adopting a different accent means that you belong to that group or you are less comfortable in your own group or feel like you have a weaker membership in your own group, then yes, there may be some type of desire to either maintain your group's accent or, if you're aspiring to a different group, to belong to a different group, to adopt that accent.
Doug Barron and several of his grad students are conducting a series of studies on how children react to certain accents at his Department of Psychological Sciences Wordplay Lab.
The first one, we are looking at actually the difference between monolingual and bilingual speakers. We are collaborating with some colleagues in Montreal, Canada, where most children grow up bilingual. And interestingly, what we have found is that both monolingual children and the bilingual children in Montreal prefer non-accented speech to accented speech. So they would rather listen to, or they would choose to be friends with, the person who speaks with less of an accent.
Including children they tested here in Arkansas. So what does that mean?
Well, we think what it means is that speaking without an accent may be associated with a little bit higher prestige, status, and power in the group. So having an accent, speaking a language with the accent of another language may be some sort of indication of less prestige, even in bilingual communities.
The first and fourth grade test subjects preferred the familiar and higher status accents, Professor Doug Barron says.
Language and accents and dialects are a cue that children use for group membership. It's very important.
So is it inevitable that certain regional accents, like language, will disappear?
There is evidence in both directions. There's evidence that greater mobility of people and also the greater access to media both can serve in some cases to weaken regional accents so people become more homogenized, but also because your language and your accent is so important for your group identity, there's some evidence or some people who suggest that perhaps hearing this bland American English all the time will help serve to maintain some of the regional accents as a sign of group or regional identity.
So next time you hear a Nolens speaker or someone from Minneapolis, Minnesota, take notice. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, June 11th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz, and with me now, Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm impressed at how that rolls off your tongue
now. It's getting easier.
You settled right into that.
Yeah.
Must have been meant to be. One of the things that you will look forward to,
mm-hmm.
as time goes by,
okay,
is summer reading programs for little people.
Always fun.
They are so much fun. I always wish I could go. And the Washington County Library System has 6 weeks of summer programming called Fizz Boom Read that's for kids in kindergarten through fourth grade around at the small libraries. Farmington Public Library is Mondays at 10 o'clock. West Fork is Mondays at 1. Elkins is Tuesdays at 10. Greenland is Tuesdays at 1. Lincoln is Wednesdays at 10. Prairie Grove is Wednesdays at 1. And Winslow is Thursdays at 10. And there will also be workshops for children in grades 5 and up starting this week, which includes Finding Fine Feathered Friends and Mystery Solved, which is science to find solutions to mysteries in nature. And you can find out about all of these things at your local library if you live in one of those smaller towns.
All right. I remember going to the summer reading program at the Fayetteville Library when it was on Dixon.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Those were the best days.
Yes, they were. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We are previewing the 2014 Riverfront Blues Festival in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in Harry E. Kelly Park. That's Friday and Saturday, June 20th and 21st. I'll be playing some selections from this year's performers, J.P. Soares, Little Ed and the Blues Imperials, Samantha Fish, and Paul Thorne. Again, that's the Generic Blues Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
Periodically on Ozarks at Large, we seek an expert's knowledge on a topic and ask what three things we all should know about that topic. This month, our three things attention lands on CPR. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums has more.
The origins of what eventually became cardiopulmonary resuscitation can be found in books dating back to the 19th century. Actually, the suggestion of one part of CPR, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, was made in the 18th century by the Paris Academy of Sciences. The American Heart Association places the development of modern CPR, combining mouth-to-mouth breathing with chest compressions, to 1960. Annually, millions of people receive some form of CPR training. Katie Helms, the Assistant Director of University Recreation at the University of Arkansas, learned CPR in 1999, and she's been teaching the technique to others for 12 years through the American Red Cross. Last week, I asked her if she knew of a student that had taken any of her CPR classes who had saved a life with CPR.
Every once in a while, I will hear an anecdotal story about how someone is glad that they learned a specific piece out of one of the classes that I've taught. But for the most part, no. And that's a good thing. I feel like CPR is kind of like car insurance. You hope you never need to use it. But when you do, you're really glad you have it. So I think that the efficacy of your knowledge is very important, you know, that you can walk around with that confidence and that efficacy, that you know what to do and are maybe more willing to act, you know, in a situation that requires it.
Katie and many other CPR instructors say just the knowledge that you know you can give the victim of sudden trauma valuable time until medical help arrives is itself valuable. I asked Katie Helms for three things that we should all know about CPR. Number one, she says CPR over the years has changed.
They update the curriculum every few years according to the latest medical knowledge that they have to work with, and it has gotten simpler over the past several updates, and especially with this last update, it has gotten simpler. I don't know when the next update is. The last update was done in 2012, and it has become more and more cardiac-based and cardiac-focused. And so if we can narrow it down to that specific basis, that the basis of most adult emergencies is cardiac-related, then we can simplify the curriculum to kind of affect the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And that's kind of, you know, where the updates have gone in the last few years.
Fact number two about CPR, that while a class is needed to become certified, CPR is not complicated.
It's really not. No, it's not. And the class itself is divided into a couple of different sections. And I would say that the most complicated section is the one that deals with all of the things that you need to think about and consider and prepare for before providing care. So you need to do things like obtain consent from the victim and obtain clues from the environment and the scene and the victim as to what happened. And there are a lot of decision-making points in that process. And so I would say that that is where a lot of the skills come in which you make your decisions and you prepare yourself. And then hopefully once you kind of decide what needs to be done, at that point it kind of becomes automatic. And there are only a couple of different directions to go once you assess the situation.
It's something that, gosh, anyone from, I don't know, preteen, 12, 13, up can learn.
Yes, absolutely. And there are different modules depending on the depth of training that you want and your age and who your target population is. And that's one thing that the Red Cross does pretty well is they have a lot of different modules for those different types of variables. So if you don't need or want a whole class, there is a module that is bystander only CPR. If you are working in a daycare, there is infant child CPR. If you're working where I am at the university, where I don't see a lot of children in my workplace, there's adult, CPR for adults. And so you can kind of do a good job of mixing and matching the components that are right for your situation.
How difficult is it then to find a class to enroll in, and how long does it take?
Finding a class is pretty simple. You can go through the American Red Cross website, and they have an online tool where you type in your zip code and you find a class. And so once you get to the main American Red Cross website, which is redcross.org, you're going to look for the health and safety and training links. You know, they have some of the other components of their organization, like the disaster relief on there too. So just steer towards the health and safety training parts. And then there is a function where you can look locally and regionally for all the different types of classes, not just CPRs and first aids, but things like lifeguarding, CPR first aid in Spanish. Mm-hmm. I think they even have pet CPR and
they
first
do,
aid.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about that, but it looks interesting. So, you can see their menu of classes and what's around. A lot are taught at the Jones Center. I know that that's a local training site that they use heavily. And then at the University of Arkansas, we offer some limited classes to the public. We do a lot specifically for university purposes, but we also offer some to the public, like adult CPR, first aid, AED, and then we also offer lifeguarding modules to the public as well.
And the third thing Katie Helms wants us to know about CPR is that modern CPR increasingly includes automated external defibrillators, or AEDs. Many public spaces and private businesses now have AEDs stationed on their walls.
AEDs are more and more common, and as they become a more substantial part of the CPR process, you see those married quite a bit now. So yes, it's easy to find a CPR class that includes the AED component, and in fact, that's probably more common to see that now, the CPR with AED, than it is to just see CPR by itself.
And the AED is a lot more simple than people might realize.
It is.
Once you know the two or three basic things.
It is simple, and it is also very intimidating.
Yes.
And I think a class is very valuable in learning how to use it. It is simple to use, yes, but I think a class helps you
yes.
to look at it, play with it, learn what it does do and what it doesn't do, dispel any myths about it.
Know where to place the paddles.
Know where to place it. Hear it, turn it on, hear it talk to you, kind of experience that sense of urgency and follow its instructions, in a safe situation. Absolutely. And an AED is very, very safe to use. And I think that there are a lot of myths out there as far as can you hurt somebody if you shock somebody that doesn't need it? And every time I ask that question in a class, I get a lot of very concerned looks from people, and that's actually a trick question. An AED won't shock somebody that doesn't need it. So it helps dispel some of those myths and helps you realize that it is very safe and you can use it, and it's okay. Don't be afraid to put it on somebody and turn it on if the situation requires it. Don't be afraid, because
it does the self-diagnosis.
Correct. The AED won't let you mess up, but that's not common knowledge. You know, I think a class really helps to help people to realize that.
Katie Helms is the Assistant Director of University Recreation at the University of Arkansas. She teaches CPR on campus through her training with the American Red Cross. If you're interested in taking a CPR class, there are many available through the Red Cross, the American Heart Association, as well as other agencies. Simply put the words CPR class, followed by your city, into a search engine. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. It's never too early to start planning your weekend, and this week there are plenty of things happening in Northwest Arkansas. For example, the Amtrak exhibit train will be on display in Springdale this Saturday and Sunday. The train, which is part of the National Railway Historical Society's National Convention, will be open to the public from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and there is no admission charge. Visitors will be able to learn about Amtrak's history, discover the future of high-speed rail, work the signal display and engineer stand, and much more. While there, you can also visit the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad Museum. The Amtrak exhibit train will be stationed at the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad Depot on Emma Avenue in downtown Springdale. For more, visit amrailroad.com.
The 10th Annual Wing Fest will be serving up the best wing recipes local restaurant chefs can offer at Rodeo of the Ozarks this Saturday. The event will feature wing samplings from 12 area restaurants, kids' activities, a custom chopper giveaway, and live music from Leah and the Mojo Doctors, and Hot Licks. Tickets are $10 each for the event, which is scheduled from 6 to 10 p.m. Awards will be given in four categories: Best Traditional Buffalo, Most Exotic, Best Overall People's Choice, and Best Overall Judge's Choice. More information is available at ParsonsStadium.com.
The Rogers Municipal Airport is hosting an aviation fly-in drive-in event from 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. this Saturday. Events include the 12th annual fly-in breakfast, where donations will be accepted and they will be used to purchase Christmas gifts, clothing, and school supplies for children and families in need at the Hallie Martin Head Start in Rogers. The 2014 FAA safety stand-down is scheduled for 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. and will include an FAA roundtable discussion. Weather permitting, free flights will be available for children 8 to 17 years old. Additional information is available at rogersarkansas.com/airport.
If you've ever wanted to learn how to kayak, you can do just that the next two Sundays at Hobbs State Park near Rogers. An instructor from the American Canoe Association will lead the classes on a calm part of Beaver Lake. The classes are scheduled for Sundays, June 15th and 22nd, and cost $50. Kayaks, paddles, and life vests will be provided, but those registering should bring their own lunch and sunscreen. Participants must be at least 16. For more information or to register, call 789-5000.
Ozark Folkways and Velda Brotherton will present a workshop from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday. The workshop, titled How to Write Stories That Captivate, is for novice as well as experienced writers. Velda has been writing for 29 years and has published 12 fiction and 6 nonfiction books. Velda will provide one-on-one assistance, and everyone will be involved in brainstorming and capturing ideas. You can bring a laptop or your pen and paper. Lunch is on your own, so guests can brown bag it, or they can join the group at Grandma's for a delicious Ozark meal. The workshop costs $25, and the group is limited to 20. OzarkFolkways.com for more information.
Rodeo grounds typically sound like this.
Yeah.
But what about this? Parsons Stadium in Springdale, home to Rodeo in the Ozarks, was the host of the Monster Truck Racing Super Series the final weekend of May. And this weekend, the same trucks will be taking over K. Rogers Park in Fort Smith Friday and Saturday evenings. While the group was in Springdale, I visited as organizers were setting up the racetrack and as Monster Truck drivers were preparing for the weekend of competition and show.
I didn't really want to do Monster Trucks in the beginning. I wanted to build off-road vehicles, but since the autonomy kind of went down, nobody wants to spend very much money on play toys, so I got forced into doing this, and we love every minute of it.
That's 30-year-old Monster Truck driver Devin Jones. He's been driving one for 8 years. He and his father started off racing pro arena trucks, smaller versions of Monster Trucks. Devin first purchased a used Monster Truck, but it quickly no longer met his needs. So he and his father built his current truck, Barbarian.
Here we are. I mean, we've been to the World Finals in Las Vegas, did great out there, got eighth out of, I think, 32 trucks in the main field and did our first ever backflip. So, I mean, we're stepping our game up, winning a lot of championships and keep rolling with it.
The body of the truck is a 2010 Ford Super Duty pickup with many additions and modifications. So what exactly makes a truck a monster truck?
Well, right off the bat, it's just the big tires. I mean, they're over 6 foot tall and weigh about 700 pounds a piece. They're just massive. If you stand up next to it, it's about as tall as about anybody out there. And it's so massive a truck. It weighs about 10,000 pounds, so it can crush anything that's in a way. And then about 1,500 horse. So your normal car has 300 horse, or five times that.
The Barbarian is just that, uncivilized and feisty. Painted blue and red, complete with a picture of a barbarian and flames. A competition usually begins with a wheelie contest. Devin says the object is to get the truck straight vertical. Then do something like a slack willy to impress the crowd. Side-by-side racing is next, followed by a freestyle portion. He says Barbarian really likes to do a trick called the slack willy.
I can usually do them in pretty small areas where a lot of guys have to have a big wide open area. So that's mainly my trick, but I like going huge air and it just, whatever the... I feed off the crowd, and if they're sitting there getting loud for me, we're going to keep going. The slap wheelie, you just have to kind of use the either a dirt heel, and it's just timing. It's pretty much like hitting a bump on a bicycle. If you hit the front tire and it just pops it up, and you just keep riding it out, and then you finally let it down after you touch the back bar.
As one can imagine, the monster trucks take a lot of abuse. This one is just 2 years old. It might run in a competition 10 minutes a week, but the maintenance time can be up to 40 hours a week. As an owner, operator, and driver, he says the upkeep is like another job. Devin is also responsible for hauling Barbarian across the country to the 45 shows they participate in each year. To do so, he has a large tractor trailer truck painted a bright purple. This is also where he calls home. It has a living space, room to carry his truck and its large tires, a personal car for getting around in towns, and a working mobile shop, complete with welding equipment. Anything and everything needed to fix Barbarian. The cab of Barbarian is stripped down to bare bones.
It's made actually for me. The seat's made for me. It's a NASCAR-style seat. That way it's all protected. It's just a lot of tubing. Because, I mean, if you roll over one of these trucks, it is 10,000 pounds, and sometimes we'll be 20 foot up in air when we land. So it's all safety for us. It's safety for the crowd.
The only radio is a kill radio that track officials can use to shut the truck off in case of emergency. There are strict safety rules imposed by the Monster Truck Racing Association. When driving, Devin dons a multi-piece fire suit and helmet that meet NASCAR ratings. Concentration and a steady hand must be helpful in driving, but Devin says a good monster truck driver also has a level head.
Some guys go out there and if they lose, they just get so hot and they just kind of get frustrated, then everything can go downhill from there. So nobody can really rile me up. I love winning, but I also love the crowd being entertained. So even if I win, if I lose, we're still sitting out there doing the best we can for the crowd.
In his 8 years, there have only been a few moments that he's been really scared. He says he once came close to hitting a building. But he says being frightened just comes with the territory when you are seeking air in a large truck at 45 shows a year. Last year, he recalls doing 6 venues in 9 days. This is the busy season with summer and fall events and fairs. He's also been out of the country, to Moscow and other parts of Europe and to Puerto Rico. Though the sport is typically American, he says he has seen arenas jam-packed with up to 30,000 people in Moscow. Barbarian traveled to Russia in a container on an ocean liner, taking about 3 weeks to get there and 3 to get back. In this area, Devin is a bit of a hometown favorite as he grew up in Miami, Oklahoma. He drove a show there just last weekend and is expected again to be the favorite this weekend in Fort Smith. Because the alleyway leading into many an arena is intended for horses and bulls, the trucks must drive in on their small tires, the large ones being brought in by forklift. Once the tires are changed, the trucks call Parsons Arena or K. Rogers Park home for the weekend. Brad Darnell is with Monster Events Incorporated, a company that organizes events like this. He coordinates the drivers of the 6 Monster trucks, 12 Pro Arena trucks, and Freestyle Motocross. Brad has been in the business for over 30 years. The sport began in the 1970s with trucks like Bigfoot, though he says a monster truck show has changed much over the years.
Back in the day, just for a truck to climb onto cars, it was a real slow deal and really kind of boring. Now, if you see one of those old videos from where monster trucks started, and now it's progressed to these are fast. Now these trucks are so state-of-the-art and so advanced technologically that they can hit the cars at 25, 30 miles an hour and jump, you know, hundreds of feet.
Brad arrives to every show a few days early to set up the courses and prep cars. Typical to many monster truck competitions, there are cars, piles of old cars for the trucks to mount, run over, or jump. The vehicles are acquired locally through USA Metal Recycling. Destined for the crusher, the monster trucks just help them out a bit.
What we look for are big, nice cars, like the Cadillacs are good cars. They come in with glass in them, and the rodeo grounds, that's special sandy dirt, so we have to prep the cars, take all the glass out, take the headlights out, and so on, so that we don't leave any glass in the arena from the trucks running over them. So we got them out here, and we're prepping them, taking all the glass out, and getting them ready to go in the arena.
Cars are an integral part of the course. There are 2 stacks of 5 cars each, plus the car van car stack.
The trucks will run side by side racing over that. They'll also do a chase course, which one starts on one stack and the other on the other directly opposite. They'll run opposite directions like a chase. We call that Chicago-style racing. And then there'll be a car and then a van and a car. We call it the car van car stack. And that's basically just for freestyle.
The freestyle portion takes place at the end of the show and is the most popular with the viewers. The drivers get 90 to 120 seconds to do whatever they want to do, like going backwards over the cars, popping wheelies, or flipping their trucks. There are judges in the stands that will judge their freestyle performance. The judges for the Springdale competition were members of the community who entered a contest and won the opportunity to take part in this way. Before the Friday evening show, they partook in a training session to learn what to look for. Before the show, attendees have the chance to ride in a monster truck. The Mighty Monster Bus gives a squirrely ride for $10. On Friday evenings, there's a free pit party. Shows begin at 7:30, but from 6 to 7, people are let out onto the arena floor and given the opportunity to walk up to the trucks, visit with the drivers, and take pictures. For more information, search Monster Truck Racing Super Series on Facebook. To see pictures or watch videos of Barbarian and Devin Jones, visit barbarian4x4.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's American jazz with a European twist, including the gypsy jazz group Amerinouche.
They've got the swing and the jazz,
and that Eastern European gypsy influence all melted together in a very American-sounding version, which is fascinating to me.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Still on the Hill will perform songs from Once a River, story songs about the Beaver Lake watershed, June 20th at 7 p.m. at Ozark Folkways in Winslow. Still on the Hill will give away 100 CDs at this free community performance on a first-come, first-served basis. More information at stillonthehill.com.
Before we end today's show, there are a couple of things we want to remind you of. First, nominations will be accepted until June 15th for the 21st Annual Ernie Dean Award for Valor in Journalism. The award recognizes Arkansas journalists or writers whose works best exemplify the spirit, style, and courage of its namesake. Nominations can be sent to Charlie Allison at 106 Davis Hall, University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, Arkansas, 72701, or by email to calison@uark.edu. The award will be presented at a special event in the fall at the Journalism Department and at the University of Arkansas. Dean was one of the early graduates of the college's Journalism Department and later taught journalism at the university. Nominations made in 2013 will continue to be considered for the 2014 award.
The University Library Special Collections Department is commemorating Women's History Month with the exhibit Literary Lifelines. It's on Level 1 of Mullins Library through June 15th. The exhibit showcases photographs, maps, and documents that demonstrate the major role women played in the creation and development of public libraries in the United States during the 19th and 20th centuries. In Fort Smith and Morrilton, club women were awarded grants made available by industrialist Andrew Carnegie to support the construction of their public libraries. For more, visit libinfo.uark.edu.
The 2014 Eureka Springs Blues Weekend begins tomorrow and runs through Sunday. Blues Weekend features local, regional, national, and international blues acts and is held in venues all around Eureka Springs. Headliner shows are held in the historic city auditorium. Late shows will be in the Barefoot Ballroom atop the 1905 Basin Park Hotel. And bands are playing in clubs all around town. Free music in Basin Spring Park will begin on Friday at noon with Brandon Santini. For tickets and more information, visit EurekaSpringsBlues.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Goshen.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host, Kyle Kellums. Any That's stories right. you want to preview for our listeners?
Well, let's see. I talked to a woman yesterday about the bottom dollar effect, just kind of the satisfaction that you receive when you buy a product if you don't have very much money.
Oh, so
that'll be on tomorrow.
Okay, well, looking forward to that. Well, we will end today's show with some music by Moon Jr. The song is called Bloodshot. The band will perform tomorrow night along with What Moon Things at Smoke and Barrel Tavern. I'm sensing a theme there. You can find out more about the band at moonjrband.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great Wednesday.